can check it out.
Following is an unrehearsed interview with Bob Barger by Libby Frost with the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview is conducted at Mr. Mark Barger's home in Estill County in Irvine on July 10th, 1978.
Mr. Barger, could you tell me where you were born?
I was born in this county, Estill County, this, at an area known as Locust Branch. That's the name of the post office. It's about a stone's throw from the Madison County line, up Red Lick Way. Midwife, Mrs. Baker, I'm told. Mm-hmm. Didn't have doctors much then. That was 1901, January the 17th.
January 17th,
1901. I'm now 77.
Who were your parents?
Mr. and Mrs. Elias Barker. Elias.
So have you lived in Estill County all your life?
All but 3 years. Mm-hmm. I served 3 years on the Great Lakes as a sailor. That's where I enlisted. Mm-hmm. That was 1918, 1919, and 1920. Otherwise, I've been here all my life. Mm-hmm.
Did you go to school here in Estill County?
Yes, I went to the one-room school, Red Lick, until 1913. Then we moved to Irvine. We lived in Irvine then. And there's where I got interested in being a printer. There was a printing office there close to this livery stable where my father was employed. It was the old Irvine Sun, edited by John W. Walker, who later became famous as an attorney and office holder. And he was on the staff there. It was a one-legged printer. And by being close to this other place, I got to going up there, and I got to know some type, and it's sort of glamorous to me. I got my fingers in, got the second type, the old way now. The printing offices then were very primitive. They'd had about two cases of 10-point type and 8-point type, and a few display cases, type cases, but the newspaper then only had two pages. There were four pages in all, but two of them were printed locally, front and back, and the inside was ready print, we call it, furnished by Western Newspaper Union of Cincinnati. It was ready printed already. It had such things as the International Sunday School Lesson on it, maybe some national news, and the ads usually, that helped pay for it. You didn't have to pay much for that, because they covered their expenses from advertising such as Lydia Pinkham and Smith Cough Drops and Black Drop, such things as that. Mm-hmm. When I had about 300 circulation then, that shipment would come in every week before press time.
Come in by rail?
No, it would come by
mail.
Post office. Uh-huh. Mail, a package, yeah.
Where was the printing shop in Irvine?
That was on Broadway, at the bend of Broadway, if you've been down there. It was on the, you know where Elliott & Witt Ford Company is there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, those, where the cars, extra cars is placed now. There was a large warehouse there then, two-story warehouse. It'd been built for skating rink upstairs. It had good hardwood floors on it. And this printing office had been brought in, and they separated a section of it there. The printing office was on the west end of it. And it had a, this is a very interesting, it had the Campbell Press. You just print two pages at a time on that. And I noticed the copyright on that old press was about 1868. Later on, I'll tell you what become of it. We printed every Friday. The publication day was Friday.
Mm-hmm. And the paper then was delivered on Saturday then?
Went through the mail. No deliveries in Irving then. That came later. Very one when you had mail delivered.
Mm-hmm.
It just went in the mail. You know, we had 32 post offices then. All of them were directed to individual names of these several post offices.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you first wandered into the printing shop there?
12 years old. That was 1913. See, I'm a year behind the calendar.
Did you work like after school or?
No, I went to school. I went to the Irving Grade School then. I was in the seventh grade when I came from Red Lake, where mm-hmm. I lived. I just went in there after school for a while. I was apprentice devil. You know what that term means?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think I messed around there a little bit, helped throw in type or set some type a while. They gave me 50 cents a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't regularly employed for some time. That's the way it originated.
What kinds of material was put on the two pages you said that you made up?
Personals mostly, visitings, and this one-legged printer had a special column he called Joe Bush Says. He commented on personalities in the community and a little bit of that, but now mostly it was a column of personals. Of course, had some court news from the circuit court, we said, a list of the jurors maybe, and a few things like that, the results of trials, a few things like that. But the news was very scanty. You wouldn't have to set up over three or four galleys for the whole paper at that time. Now that went on through 1914. I continued to go to school, and my folks moved over to Panola in Madison County for a couple of years there, 1915 and 16. So Mr. Walker got me to stay at his home and work after school down there. I got set in type for him pretty well all through 14. And sometime in early 1950, I believe January the 1st, he suspended publication. See, this newspaper had been started as a political gimmick. They were having elections in Estill County then, and they had another newspaper known as the Tribune. It was edited by a Democrat, and so the Republicans wanted a competitor. This printing office was already up there in that place. It'd been put there, been edited and run by somebody else. Probably it was the Estill Eagle then, way back 1908 or 9. And it was there and wasn't being used, so they got Mr. Walker to resurrect that thing, and he called it the Irving Sun. But after that, he was an attorney studying law in a prominent lawyer's office down there, and he was admitted to the bar, actually began to practice law. He didn't have no more interest in that. He suspended that publication, but another fellow came in then, and named Guy Bell. He stayed there for 15 and 17, I believe, and I worked for him some. and continued to go to school, and I finished the grade up here. They had no high school in Estill County then, but this high school principal started teaching high school subjects. For about 2 years there, I'd go up there every afternoon, and he'd teach such things as ancient history, the algebra, and Latin, and physical geography, and things of that kind. And I had quite a background of high school before the first high school was established in Estill County. That was in 1970. And the old Estill Collegiate Institute, that's the middle school now here on Main Street, if you see it there. They'd been having private schools out there and private tutors and so on. But the Estill County established that one. I was the first pupil to enroll, myself and two others. We were in the first class, three of us.
Mr. Walker, was he a Republican then?
Uh-huh.
How did the politics get involved in the paper?
Well, back in those days, politics was pretty competitive, you know. Newspapers, in most towns, of course, you don't have that many now. It's business now. It's changed quite a bit. Back in those days, you need the Republican paper and the Democrat paper, most every little town throughout Kentucky. And they'd argue politics and issues and things of that kind editorially, don't you see? And after that, of course, after they suspended, Mr. White, D.R. White, was editor of the other paper. Then I went to work some for him.
This was the Tribune?
That's the Tribune.
Uh-huh.
That was in 1916.
Who did the writing of the editorials? Mr. Walker or
yeah.
Mr. White?
Yeah. Now let's see. Well, Mr. Vinson of Texas, Big Wells, Texas, came to Irving in 1970. He purchased the Tribune. And I continued to go to high school and come down afternoons and Saturdays. I worked for 15 cents an hour and was able to buy my clothes and a few things like that. I worked with him there through all of 1917. That was the war year, of course. The war broke out April 6, 1970. But I had an older brother, 8 years older than myself, who had become a sailor on the Great Lakes, crewman on the oar boats. And I got restless about the high school because they had a flu epidemic here then, and they closed up the high school during that epidemic. That interrupted my high school, so I got a little restless, and it sounded good, like going up north anyway. So I went with him in 1918 to the Great Lakes, up to Cleveland and on up to Ashtabula. Went aboard a big oil carrier, the Pontiac. And I become a deckhand, promoted to deck watch, and then boatswain. Finally, the third year, I was a wheelsman, a helmsman, and I steered that ship all over the Great Lakes, went into all the ports up there. Duluth, Buffalo, Cleveland, Ashtabula, Toledo, Lorain, Marquette, Michigan. We went in there more than any because that was the ore. Cleveland Cliffs Iron Company owned the boat and also owned vast fields of ore up there. We went into Marquette, Michigan quite often. It's very interesting.
Did you run into your brother there?
He was with me all 3 years. Mm-hmm. A little later, he continued to advance. He took his examination for captain's license, and he got to being an officer on the books after I left up there.
What was your brother's name?
James.
Did you ever witness any wrecks, or were you ever involved in any shipwrecks? Or?
Well, there's one very interesting, I think I should tell you about that. This old captain was T.E. Murray from St. Catherine, Ontario. That's close to Niagara Falls. He took a liking to my brother, and he liked me. That's why I was promoted pretty fast. I got to be a boatswain there, that boatswain equipped. And he said, bring the boy up here. I told him, I said, look, I can't splice ropes and things. That's all right. The mate can do it for you. Of course, the boatswain supervises the crews, the workers, painters, and those that chip rust and so on, and they help you land the ship and pull the hatches up and things of that kind. The boatswain did that. I did that the fall of 1918. And what else did you want to know?
The captain?
Oh, Captain T. Murray. He told him to bring me up there and so on, and says, now, he wants to be a wheelman, says he'll take that boatswain job and hold it the rest of the year. Next year, you can bring him to the pilot house, and Jim, you can steer him through the channels. See, a wheelman back in those days, he were on 6 hours. 3 hours as a watchman on the front, and the other one in the insides handling the wheel. And he says, we'll alternate, you're supposed to alternate. But says, Jim will take it no matter where you are, through those channels. But it wasn't long, he didn't have to come in and leave me. I just took him through the channel myself. St. Clair River, Detroit River, up the channels at Toledo and all around. I was got very proficient, but I did say so myself. And but anyway, one night we were on Lake Superior. This was the last year. George Nile was the first mate. He wasn't too efficient. He'd been a captain, and because he'd had some wrecks, they demoted him and just made him a first mate. He's from Wolf Island. That's in St. Lawrence River, a small island between Detroit and between New York and Quebec, I think. He didn't know too much about that. So one night a big storm came from the northeast. When your ship goes up without a load, you get your oar on the upper end. They go light, they call it. And to make speed, they'd taken all the water out of the ballast tanks, and he was riding high, see. And but when this storm came up, he didn't imagine that it was going to bother the ship. But the captain was more experienced. He began to see the ship roll. He come up out of his quarters, and he noticed what was about to happen. And he had the engineer start pumping water into those ballast tanks, and to put it back down in the water so it wouldn't capsize. And this was interesting. That went on for about 24 hours. The men who'd been wheeling up there got sick, including my brother. I was immune from seasickness, and they put me at the wheel. I stayed there night and day until well next day. And the steward brought me coffee, and I stayed right there and never did get sick. But the captain took charge, and they finally got water coming into the ballast tanks. Of course, he'd go over this way a while, and they'd catch a little water in the hot pits. And then we got over on that side, they'd take a little more, and finally got the water in there. And he headed directly north. That hit us about 50 miles east of Keweenaw Point. That's Upper Peninsula. Had us go directly north, and we went in behind Michipicoten Island. That's close to the Canadian shore. And we stayed there until that storm passed away, before we got on the path again. That was almost an accident. It could have been tragic. But the old captain took charge and kept us out of it.
How come a landlubber from Estill County was immune to seasickness?
I've never been. I've been on ships since. We took the trips, Hell and I did, on the Great Lakes and on the passenger boats later on. And she just gets sick, but it didn't bother me at all. I don't know why. I never get sick on plane either. I've flown lots on planes, but I took her to Washington with me one time, and she just got the sweat in her hands, and she went on the aspirins and everything, and she just came right on the plane. That was very interesting, those 3 years. Now, if you're wondering why I left in 1921, the World War I had ended and we had a depression in this country. No demand for ore. The ships didn't go out much, and they used to go out in April, but I came home, and Captain Murray asked me to, in August, that's late, see, to come to Port Huron and have you fit out the Pontiac. Well, I was working then, I'll tell you about that later, in the printing office down there. I figured that starting in August, there wouldn't be much of a season. I declined. I regret, I sent a telegram and told him I'm sorry it couldn't come. That ended my seafaring career. But my brother continued in that business and finally got in the Coast Guard in 1932, and he stayed there until he retired. He married in Milwaukee and had his wife there and so on. Now, I came back in 21, and as I say, the ore boats were not going, and this fellow had resurrected the old Irving Sun in 1919. Now, that fellow's name was Cheney, Robert Cheney. Knowing I was somewhat of a printer, he found me and asked me to come to work for him. I went to work for him in June 1921. Up there in this very place. And they had changed the name to the Irving Times then.
Was it still a Republican paper? Or?
He was supposed to be, but he was a hair-lipped fellow and couldn't write much, and there wasn't too many editorials in it then. But his sponsor was James A. Wallace, president of the bank, Farmers Bank, and a millionaire here. And he had helped him financially get started. He loaned money at the bank, he owned notes, and encouraged others to sign notes for him. He bought an old Linotype. That's the first one up there. And so I went up there and went to work for him in June. But he was sort of an irresponsible fellow. He got drunk in August, left town on August the 21st, and I didn't hear from him for 10 years. He went somewhere. He gave some cold checks before he left. He got arrested over in Brea, and they gave him a cold check for the fine over there, and he couldn't face up to that and other things, so he left town. Well, I was piddling along there after that, getting the paper out myself. Meantime, I'd learned to run that Linotype. I'd done pretty well with it. And I had a couple of fellows there working for me. And we got to getting the paper out all right. But I wasn't familiar with his bookkeeping or his contracts or his rates or anything. But after a certain time, some of those checks began to come in on their own. National advertisers, their budgets would let them pay you. Those checks got to coming in. Then I started going around, seeing a few ads in the paper and collecting a few ads on the ads around town, and some of them would pay me, and some of them would tell me that Cheney had bought some suit of clothes or something and didn't know anything, and such things as that. I had a lot of trouble getting straightened out. I collected enough money to pay the help. I didn't take anything for myself, because I accumulated a little money on my lakes. I had a little bank account of my own. And I went on until about the 1st of January. Mr. Wallace owned the building, and apparently was had more interest in machinery up there than anybody else. And I went to him. I said, "Mr. Wallace, I have to leave here." I said, "That ain't my newspaper up there. Chain is gone. I haven't heard a thing from him. Don't know where he is." "Oh," he said, "hello, you can't do that." He said, "You just have to run that paper yourself." I said, "Yes, but it isn't mine." He says, "I'll make it yours. Go down right to the bank and sign your name on them notes, get to work and pay them notes off, and it's yours." So that's the way I got possession of the Irving Times. I became the owner officially in January 1922. Now, I continued to run that paper through all the years. In 1924, though, he built me a building right down there in front of the City Hall. It's now, you see a furniture store in there, Curtis. I went and moved the plant down there. And I stayed there until 1968. My machinery was old, and meantime, I bought a new line type in 1928, pretty old one then. They came in and set that one up back there. I modernized it to a certain extent. Had saw trimmers and stereotype machines. I had job presses in there and things of that kind, but still run the paper off on that old camera. And finally, in 1966 now, I decided I'd go to Georgetown, and that man over there offered to print my paper for me. Offset. I set the type up here on my linotype, made a proof of it on the old camel, just one, pasted the ads on then, just like you're doing now on offset, and take them over there, and he made a photograph over there and put it in the arc machine there, and I did that for 18 months, go to Georgetown every Wednesday and get the paper printed over there. But meantime, Mr. Matthews of the Newspapers Incorporated at Shelbyville, he was anxious to acquire some more newspapers. He contacted me and wanted to buy mine. I gave him a price, and I didn't hear any more from him for about 2 years. And my competitor, the Esper Herald, incidentally, they came here in 1927. They had gone bankrupt down there. Well, they just owed so many people they were about to go under. But I was very frugal and I wasn't in debt at all. You know, wait a minute. They contacted Matthews and wanted to sell. He came up here and he said, "I don't want to buy a paper in the town with this competitor. If this man up here, I made him an offer some time ago, if he'll sell, I'll buy you." He came up and said, "Will you sell your paper? This fellow wants to sell his down here. If I put you together," he said, I stood about and I told my wife, I said, "I'm 67 and I'm going to drop dead some of these days. You can't sell a newspaper that isn't going." I said, "I stood about tonight and let you know." And we talked it over. I said, "I better sell that. I'll take that little hunk of money he's going to give me and I'll put it in the savings account. And he wants me to work on it." And he said he made the deal down there with the Esco Hurl, and they owed so much, mortgages and all of these things. It took them a little while to settle up on some things. He advanced some money to them, paid some of the debts. Some of it had mortgages on, and he got the people to take them back. And he bought a plate maker down there. He didn't need it all. I didn't need no thing. That's a big investment, $10,000 in that, just to make a few cuts. I got mine made at Lexington. Send a photograph over today and be back on Wednesday for $2-3. They had to have capital, and I didn't have to invest anything. But he wanted it down there. He expanded too fast and got in trouble. Anyway, the time rolled around, they got it straightened out, their debts down there. He brought his accountant up to my office. He says, "Well, they about ready to sell down there. He said, you owe anything? I said, I owe $80 for the paper I got here last week. That's all. And he said, that ain't nothing. That's just an open account. He says, well, my accountant, he said, what about your taxes? You want this all one time? I said, I don't know. I don't need it all. He said, why can't we pay you a third of it this year, a third next year, a third the next? All right, that's all right. So he gave me a check for $4,000. And then there, no, $5,000. He gave me $20,000 there. It was just my machine was so antiquated, you know. And so he says, now you have to run the paper, that fellow down there. He said, he's just an operator. He don't know anything about business or editing or anything else. You want to be the editor and the manager. It's all in your hands. Irving Downs. But of course now I had a stroke in 74, April, my leg down there. I had to retire. Mm-hmm. Now, in this period of Edson Irving Downs, I guess you want some interesting things about that. I made some notes about some of these things here. Some of the problems I faced down there. You got the back bell. 1922, of course, I was faced with two or three problems right off. The one was the Ku Klux Klan came to town. And, of course, I didn't believe in the Ku Klux, hooded empires and things. And I, early, with the sister, Mr. Walker, got to write in the editorials in opposition to the Ku Klux. They came here and burnt some crosses out here and messed around. Came to the Baptist church one night, gave them $50. I happened to be treasurer of the church, too, at that time. And they laid it down and left, walked in there with their wigs on and so on. And the following Sunday, then, the congregation took a vote on it and said it wouldn't accept the money. They ordered 70 to 16 to return the money. But that identified me with the Ku, in opposition to the Ku Klux. Meantime, this old man Benson I told you about was running the Tribune down there. He had lined himself up with the Ku Klux and claimed to be the official organ of the Ku Klux Klan. And he had a stepdaughter named Helen Smock, and I'd sat tight beside her, a very fine girl and all. Now, I found out who the Ku Kluxes were by this method. They'd meet down here at Linwood Hall and the cars would park. I got the licenses off the cars and then I'd check over there. I compiled quite a list of them. And finally, sometimes one would desert the thing and tell me who was up there and things like that. I think I still got that list in there now. Many of them are my good, upstanding friends. And I'll tell you who they were. Of course, you know the Ku Klux then was opposed to Catholics and Jews and niggers. And they accused me of being against the Klan because my grandfather was a Catholic, which he was, Ned Derby. And I was liberal in my thinking, of course, but it went on, Ku Klux did, and this barber that I was favored down there, William Parsons, I was in his chair one day and he shaved me and he got to criticize me about that and I thought he was going to cut my throat. And he said, I know what the trouble is. He says, you're just a Catholic. He said, I know all about this and this and that and other. And, well, anyway, that was that incident. But 2 years later, he repented and sent for me and apologized. Sister and I come over to his house about it and eat dinner with him and we buried the hatchet about that. But let me tell you how the Ku Klux ended though. Now that's interesting. The man who was organizing was named A.G. Girvin, G-I-R-V-E-N. He was running the hotel on Main Street there now. It was known as the St. Catherine Hotel. That's where the 10-cent store is, Jim Hayden's clothing store, and where the library formerly was situated. That was the lobby. And the upstairs, he rented rooms. It was a hotel, that's what it was. Now, he was wearing a big Masonic pin, and he made a big front of that. He had a goatee, kind of like Colonel Sanders. That's that type of man. And he mixed socially with the finest of people in this community. They'd have big dance, he'd go, and dance for the socialites and things of that kind. He was accepted in a big way, and including this Helen Smart that I told you about, stepdaughter. Finally, though, they had a shooting over there in his hotel. Somebody shot Dan McGeorge in one of the rooms up there. And it came to court, started court, just having a trial about it. And so they brought this maid over there, Bessie somebody, to testify about it. And she told about it. She said that he, when he registered in there, you could either have a woman or you, could, be, you didn't have to have one, this woman, with or without. She was testifying in Judge Hurst's court about it over there. And after she finished her testimony about that, Hurst told her, said, you go down to the grand jury room now and swear just what you were for here. Somebody, Fluxer, I guess, eased out of the courtroom and went over and told Gervin what was being done in the courtroom. He left that night and never heard of again. So the thing fell through rapidly after that. Certainly, the Ku Klux collapsed. Is that interesting? Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Was he outspoken for the Klan? Was he identified as a Klan leader?
You mean Gervin? He was the organizer. Mm-hmm. They had meetings, you see, and he'd induct them, install them as members, you know, and take them over and do this and that. And
but he tried, did he try and keep his identity a secret at all?
No. Yeah, he was known as a, I don't know, as a cyclop or something like that. He had a title. No, they didn't put their hoods on except when they have meetings going to burn across the town. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they hold their meetings, of course, they'd be secret, they'd be tiled, somebody at the door, and nobody in except members, you know. But anyway, when that happened, Mr. Benson called me down there. Bob, I want to tell you something. I'm sorry this happened. I was taken in. They fooled me. I don't want to ask you to do one thing. I know you're going to write about it. I said, yeah, I'm going to write something about it. I said, he says, would you leave out Helen's name? Well, I said, Mr. Benson, I'm an old man like that. I said, I wouldn't harm a thing on Helen's hair. She's a wonderful companion of mine, and I like her, and you don't think I'm that low down enough to involve her in this thing. Well, I just thought I'd ask you, said. Now, you see there, how they fanned the flames and this community tore it up. And, most everybody in that thing were Masons. They took them in, too, pretty well. It's a very reputable organization here, and I belong to it now. But that hatred lasted and plagued me for years, you know. They were whipped and defeated, and they were wrong, but they couldn't forget me being against them, don't you see? It plagued me quite a while. And another thing that happened in 1920, I'm telling you about the problems. When I was just 21 years old, and I had to learn to write even. I hadn't been writing anything, but I just picked it up and watched other papers. I was self-made on my writing. They had a railroad strike over here in 1922. And the Ellenian Railroad Company ran an ad in my paper wanting employees. Well, they brought a delegation down there and wanted me to take the ad out. Of course, I'm being free American and everything, and believe in free enterprise, and don't like to be dominated by anybody. I I said, no, I ain't gonna do that. You folks want to run an ad, my space is for sale. You folks want that ad, run you one. I'm gonna run this my own. Well, that hindered me some for a good many years. Strike lost, it was broken up, but they continued to not like me over that for a good many years after that.
This was the workers who were on strike?
Yeah.
And they resented your running the ad?
They didn't want me to run that ad in the paper for the Elgin Railroad Company. They'd always been my customer anyway, running ads about the service and things of that kind. I couldn't refuse that kind of an ad and wasn't going to let somebody come and tell me I couldn't run an ad in the paper. Well, those are the things, but here's the best one of all, I think. We had in this town, I told you about Mr. Wallace, fine gentleman, elected state treasurer later on, very prominent, my benefactor. He had a brother named T.Q. Wallace, and he was a lawbreaker here, sort of an Al Capone type of a person. He was shot and killed down here on May the 19th, 1923. But before that, back in 22, he'd been arrested for cell liquor, was tried in the county court by a woman jury and convicted. I put that in the paper. Well, he came up there and had his pistol with him. He told me, he said, I don't want my name in this paper no more. And seeing there again, I'm not going to waste a bullet on you. I'm going to beat your brains out with this gun. I was still very independent. I didn't think anybody had an idea tell me how to run the newspaper. I was trying to be a good editor, community leader, and things like that. Now, that was in early 23, I'd say. But he got to be such a ruffian here that the county judge and others decided that something had to be done about it. So they sent for an undercover man from the alcohol division. He came in, he went up there and bought a pint of liquor from T.Q. Wallace. And of course he went back and got him a search warrant then. That's the basis for a search warrant. And arrested him. And of course he went down. Then he didn't have no way to get in and out of early except by train. No cars or highways or taxis or anything like that. That man went down there at this Riverview Hotel at the end of Main Street and registered there and until he could get the late train back to Lexington that night. But Wallace was so incensed about it, he went down there and decided to kill him. He went into the desk and asked the clerk if that fellow was registered there. He sensed trouble about this. No, I said, he ain't here. He said, I know damn well he is. He's registered here. And he went on out on the sidewalk. He'd sit down there and wait for him. Meantime, this clerk got word that fellow in this room. He said, that man's waiting for you out there to cause trouble. Of course, he was a crack shot himself, this prohibition man. And he came out all right. Wallace got right up, started shooting at him. This fellow got behind one of those columns down there, and T.Q. kept backing up the sidewalk there, and they were shooting at each other. But his bullets were hitting this column and grazing off, but the crack shot was getting him to hit him. And he finally jammed his gun. Tom, he was trying to get it to shoot, and it wouldn't shoot. And this fellow just filled him full of bullets, and he died there on the sidewalk, T.Q. Wallace. Now, that saved me from having to decide. You see there, fate intervened there, I think. This man got killed before he could kill me. Is that interesting? Now, let me tell you again about Wallace, though, before this happened. So, what a ruffian he was, he and another fellow killed a man up on Broadway here. And they convicted him, he and H.E. Cheney, and he was to go to the pen. The sheriff took him down to the penitentiary, Frankfort. But when he got there, he found he'd been pardoned. Mr. Wallace being rich, he didn't like his brother and told him, but he said he didn't want to go with him. He paid the governor $25,000 to have Wallace and his fellow pardoned. You could buy pardons then. That was a habit. If you had enough money, anybody could get out. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
Well, that was the custom in Kentucky then. Some later governors did the same thing. Ed B. Moore followed him as governor, and he did. And Sam D. Sampson, likewise, did what he claimed his brother was doing, but anyway. You can't do it now. We've become civilized on that. But anyway, anybody with enough money could get a fellow out. He never did serve a day in the pen for that killing. That emboldened him, that's a good word, to continue with his crime records here, selling liquor and dominating politics in the city and things like that. But after he got killed down there, his brother came to me and said, well, Bob, put in the paper, but make it easy as you can. He said, we're both embarrassed as my brother. And then I said, well, we just have a simple story about him being shot, that's all. And that's all. We don't need to criticize a dead man for his record. I didn't play up his record any at all. Simply. I thought that was very interesting. I should tell you about that. That was one of the problems I faced as a young editor. Well, let's go on some more. I had some other things. I'll tell you another one. This is very, in a way, comical. This is a good one. There's a fellow here, retired engineer, named M.C. Bowman. And I used to print police court news, of course. And I had in the paper that M.C. Bowman was arrested and convicted for disorderly conduct and drunkenness. And on Monday morning, after the paper came out, he came in there and he said, I'm going to sue you for all you were. That's what in the order, Mr. Bowman. What's the trouble? Why, he said you had the paper about me being in jail, and I haven't been in no jail. Now, I said, wait a minute now. I said, I got that off the docket down there. It's balanced. You? No, he said, I wasn't in no jail. He was the talk of his voice, going to get the lawyer to sue me for all I'm worth and this and that and the other. I said, now listen, you sit down out there and let me go around here and see. I'll get to the bottom of this thing. If I've done you wrong, of course, I'll correct it. And I went down and looked at the docket, and the police judge looked over it. I said, you got M.C. Bowman here, and he says he wasn't down here. He took his pen and looked at it. Oh, he said, I forgot to put Mrs. in front of that, he said. I came back and I said, Mr. Bowman, you were absolutely right. You weren't in jail. I went down and looked at the docket and I said, I'll make a correction. It wasn't you, it was your wife. What? He says, that old bastard said, I wondered where she was over the weekend. And he said, yeah, Mr. Barker, he said, we've been friends all these years. I said, yeah. He said, well, no, we want to stay that way, don't we? I said, yeah. He said, would you just forget the whole thing and let's shake hands? And I said, well, if that's the way you want it and you go on a correction, we just drop it like it is. wasn't that interesting, though? Well, I have another that happened to me. I got more thoroughly later on as an investigative reporter. I wouldn't believe everything everybody told me, but that was early, see. One day I got a piece of the paper, a letter from down here at Palmer Post Office, outlining the wedding they had down there. Mr. John Smith, while he was there, this fictitious, and Miss So-and-so were married here at 8 o'clock on Thursday night, if that's the thing, so-and-so. And, of course, I just bit on it and run it in the paper. It sounded so normal, you know, and so-and-so was the bridesmaid. I don't know what all, just sounded so nice, you know. I put it right in the paper. Well, after the paper came out, there came a woman and her husband in there, well, and this other fellow. But she said, ooh, where'd you get that in about that marriage down there? I said, well, I got a letter here about it. He said, well, that's my four-year-old son, and it's the four-year-old daughter, this Mr. Soames over here. I said, well, somebody wrote me a letter about that. She said, let me see the letter. I got the letter out, looked at it. She looked at it, she said, well, that's my sister's handwriting. Says she hates me, and she's pulled at it. I said, well, I'll make a correct. No, no. They said it's their thing, worse than ever. Said, just forget the whole thing. I said, I don't like to get things like that. I said, that's, so you see, I was taken in. You wouldn't do that now. I'd check on that now, see whether they had a marriage license or not, or some reputable person I talked to about it. Well, what else you want to know about it? I forgot to tell you about that type I sold. That's a legend back in those days. That's one of the things that happened. And Alan here, another little girl, I hadn't met her yet much. I was wanting to go with her, but she came up there and with Laura Hatcher. And Laura was getting some birthday something other printed. And I said, well, while you're all here, would you like to see some type glass? And, yeah. I come right back here. Well, of course, the way you did that, you had type on the galley, see? You part of it back and poured some water right in there. I said, now you'll have to see that. You'll have to get down there close. They'll float up there. And of course, you got your hand right back here, see? And they get down there looking, and you just squirt that right up, and they just put, and they got on both of them, and they got so mad. I never could have a date with her for a year after that. And another legend was the printer's towel. You didn't have people calling and taking the laundry every week or anything like that. You used the towel until you could stand it up in the corner before you ever had to get another one. It'd get stiff, and soap on it, things of that kind. I thought you ought to hear about that. And now here's the best one of all, I think. And I guess that's all you want to know about. I'm getting too long here, aren't I?
No,
they're
fine.
Our press day was officially for Friday, but we never did meet the deadline. We just keep on setting, and something would come in, and we'd keep right on putting things in the paper. Maybe a late ad, the fellow would come in and say, I got to have an ad, and get a sale going on. And we'd frequently go out on over to Monday or Tuesday the following week before that paper would come out, dated the previous Friday. Well, on this occasion, on Monday, we had a killing down here. LN detective was killed. He was supposed to meet a drunk there on the train, and when he did, that fellow didn't want to be arrested, and he shot and killed him right there. Now, this happened on Monday evening. Mind you, now, the paper was dated back there on Friday. We hadn't printed yet. I rushed up there and didn't want them to scoop me on that. I got me a full story about that, you know. I put it right in the paper and it come out on Tuesday morning. The election herald commented on it and said, there's a fellow that sprints the news before it happens. that was the way it was, though. The rule just late coming out all the time. The people come in and say, "What? When's your paper coming out this week?" Things of that kind. Well, of course, later after I got competition in 27, we set a time for publication. They had to meet it. We'd meet it. Well, I told you about the child marriage and the bone nester. Oh, yeah. A woman wanted to bribe me to keep an indictment out of the paper. This young man had been indicted for seduction. She said her daughter was involved. And she'd give me $50 if I wouldn't even put that in the paper. I said, well, you don't mention your daughter. Yeah, I know, but said, when it comes out about him being arrested, they'll know he's been going there. And the fact of the matter says she's pregnant already. I said, well, lady, I ain't going to accept that bribe. I'm going to do that. I'll do it as accommodation to you, but don't you try to bribe me anymore. I said, I'll expose you. I did. I found a way to skip that one. That the fact of the matter, I left the indictments out altogether rather than I'll accommodate you, save you some embarrassment, but I don't accept bribes. $50 don't mean nothing to me. And now another one, just about like it. Dr. Strong, he's a dentist down here now. He's still here. he was a strong friend of my committee down there. They get drunk together, just drunk, drunk, drunk. And they got him, put him in jail, and finally he being drunk, Dr. Strong. He came to me, he said, Bob, Holmail his name, ain't some way we can keep Dr. Strong's name out of there? I said, make it John Strong or something, I don't know why. Bob, I ain't gonna fake no article like that. It's not ethical or anything like that. But he said, in some way we can do something with it. He's a little friend of mine. I said, well, he's never done that to me either. I'm sorry for him. He's drunk all the time, though. Hardly ever sober. He's good, then. I said, tell you what we'll do. We'll do it this way. We'll just leave out police court news now on as a policy. I've been thinking about it anyway. It's in case some of my friends, your friends too, here, little old things. And I said, I'll just confine my court reporting to the circuit courts and things of that kind of major item. Well, if you agree to that now, not scoop me on anything, I said, we'll do it that way. He said, okay. He said, that's the way we stop printing police court news. And here's another. We had a chiropractor that came in here. He took up most everybody around here. He came from Richmond over here, Dr. Casey. He went to Mr. Smithers, the vice president of Mag. I want to locate here. I want to buy up Dr. Webb. I want to be a part of the community. I'm going to join the Kiwanis Club and all. And he took him in pretty good. He told him, says, I need to borrow about $2,000 to pay Webb off up there for his equipment one day and another. Well, that's all right. He went up, had the directors loan Dr. Casey with $2,000. Then he got the buying things around town and charged them and hadn't paid them, including insurance and clothes and whatnot. And he had me get him a cook of himself and run a story about him being in town. And I got him a half tone, cost about $8. And we had that in there, but he went on a few weeks, and finally he struck up. He's married now and had a wonderful woman, a wonderful wife. He struck up with another married woman up here named Mrs. Duncan. So they left town one night, fled, never did come back. And so I got actually done that, and everybody's talking about it around town. I got that picture. It was a cut. I got to run it in the paper on occasions. Just this picture, that's all I do, see. First time I ran it was just before Christmas. I just ran this picture. It said, Merry Christmas. That's all put on it. No name, identified, but his creditors knew who it was. They said, I won't see that Dr. Casey picture in again. Well, Easter would roll around, you know, and I'd have some reason to put it in there then. And then finally, Flag Day came around in June. I put his picture in again. They kept looking, said, when are we going to see him again? And this time I said, stand by the flag. Well, we went up in the Masonic Lodge one night, and of course we installed office up there, and my friend Mark Lyle, a friend of mine here, he actually lets your office, you do what you call a proclamation. Brother Lyle gave the proclamation. And he got up and he used the formality at first, and then he wound up right on the bottom and he says, and stand by the flag. Well, the presiding officer looks and says, what kind of proclamation is that today? He says, where'd you get that? He says, oh, I know. He says, that was in the paper, wasn't it? So you see how the ramification, how it went on and on and on, don't you see? Well, he went away from here, and finally there's a local optometrist down here, Quentin Markson, came to me one day, and showed me a postcard. He said, here's a picture from Dr. Casey. I said, where is he now? I said, down in North Carolina. It was, I believe it was Steubenville. And he said on that card, let me see it. He says, I'm doing fine, got a big office, a lot of clients, and this and that. So after that, I got a I wrote down there, I got my newspaper right there, and I found out who the editor of the paper was there. And I said, I wrote him, I said, "Dear Brother Smith, we were fellow editors and all." I said, "If you wanted me to do something for you in this town, I'd do it for you. And I want you to do me a favor down there." I said, "There's a fellow down there with the name of Dr. Cation that owed me a little bill here. And would you mind sending me the name of the county judge or the officer that handles accounts like that?" He wrote me back. He said, "Brother Barker, of course I'd accommodate you. I could. But," he said, "this man you're talking about owes me $18, and I got the sheriff after him, but he got over the North Carolina line into Virginia before we could catch him." I took that letter down and showed to Quentin. I said, "Here's the fellow that was doing so well down in the North Carolina you told me about." Well, an old friend of mine down here, the family was a friend of mine. They had a son named Ossie Broughton. He was always getting drunk. And have you met him? When the police come and got him, take him down to jail. He had drank, I guess, nearly a pint or something. He just drank so much, he died down there, right in the jail, overnight. Sometime during the night, he passed away. Well, of course, I put in the paper, he was died in this kind of jail, and so on and so forth. Well, that family got mad at me about that. You didn't have to do that. Why didn't you just say he died on July the 7th or whatever it was? I said, well, everybody heard about this, I said, and they knew all about it. I said, you want me to censor it and not put in the paper? Actually, the assertion is connected with it. I didn't want to do that, but I guess there's some way you can get around it now. I don't know, but I don't think they do. They get papers. If they die in jail, they say they do. And then another one. A man hanged himself out here in Sand Hill. I said he took his life by hanging. He was found in the garage. Man apparently had managed to get the rope and hang himself. Well, that woman came in, she was mad as horn. You didn't have to say that. He said he died out there at his home. And I want to cancel my subscription. I want a refund and this and that and the other. Oh, first she came in and says, Who did this? I didn't make a difference. Who did it? Now, this was Esther Hurl. I was down there then. This happened more recently. I said, well, I'm responsible. I wrote the story. What'd you do that for? I said, well, it's facts. What'd your husband want to commit suicide for in the first place? You want me to cover that up? Well, you could have left it out some way, brother. I said, well, I ain't going to fund your money. We don't know. I got mad, too, you know. Don't usually do that, but I said, we're not going to refund your money. I said, but if you don't want the paper, I'll just give it to somebody else or we'll stop it. Well, I guess I told you about enough about that, didn't I? Mm-hmm. Oh, here's a good one. Another man committed suicide at Gamma Grocery right here on Broadway. You see it as you pass. It's still there. I think some of his folks still learn. But he committed suicide. He shot himself right through the temple. You can't do that accidentally. Pistol fell on the floor. Coroner went up there. And incidentally, he's still coroner, Wayne Cox. A brother to Ed Cox, husband of your librarian down there. But he told me, he went in an opinion that was he committed suicide. But before I could go to press for that, he came down there. He said, I had to change my verdict. I said, you did? He said, yeah. I said, what? He said, I had to make it accidental shooting. This night and heaven. I said, well, I know, but I guess you had to do that for the family, didn't you? He said, yeah. You see, insurance, suicide insurance, they won't pay you off. And they was trying to make it accidental so they get double the indemnity. I said, well, Wayne, I can't change it. If that's your review, change your verdict and that's it, I'll have to go over that. I can't go any different except, of course, it's a library. Print something about a suicide, you know, unless you have an authority for it. You know that. In the journalism, you learn that. So I had to say it was done. He killed himself back then, left there. But that was a fake. There's no question about it. Well, does that cover the newspaper thing about all you can handle out of that?
You don't mind talking about your competitor a bit and how two newspapers all this time while you were publishing?
Yes,
the Times?
Now the Tribune I told you about, this Vincent, he went broke in 1933. He borrowed money from the bank and they foreclosed. Some boat and Hazard came down here and bought his old plant, took it to Hazard. He was out of business, but he'd been running along because Esther Hurl came here in 27. Mm-hmm. But they got in trouble financially and were about to be foreclosed on several times. But that's the way it was when we consolidated now. We went in together there. But we were competitors and pretty keen at times. But meantime, I had decided, learned from experience, that crusading didn't pay off. I became a little more conservative about attacking people and getting too strong on issues and things. I began to do more writing about community fires and things of that kind. I was known to be a Republican, all right. And my friends, the ones that patronized me, knew that. But I just didn't rub anybody wrong in the other party. And finally, this whole male down there got into factionalism in his own party. And he jumped over and voted Republican a time or two, and the Democrats got mad at him. And finally, the Democrat leaders got to come to me. They said, "We know what you are. You treat us fair. We don't want you to do our printing." I said, "All right, I'll treat confidential what you want to print." I was printing for both parties before I sold out. I'd become a little bit more reserved and independent, and I looked at things. I didn't think it's too much evil in Democrats, and there's a lot of the fact of the matter, some of my Republicans, they got crooked, and I got out with them, old county judge, and he tried to steal money over there, and Mr. Walker sued him and all, and I got to rabbing him. I criticized corruption quite a bit, and I wasn't standing too strong with Republicans about that term, but I was doing the business. I had talks here then, and continued that way as I went into consolidation.
How important is the job printing to the profit of your business? Is it?
It's very profitable, but the bigger your newspaper gets, like the Lexington Herald, they don't do any. And Richmond Register just quit the other day. They've moved out there on Big Hill Pike, I think, and that's one of their employees, Harry Johnson, I believe, and somebody take the job. Work part there on Main Street. They want to devote all their time to printing the paper. It's enough to do there. But now job work, we had it down here, and I had a lot of it. We had an automatic press back there, Heidelberg, and an A.B. Dick thing. And I had two printers there, and we were just doing job work. Here's the thing, and now Daly, for some reason not have job work, Daly has to print every day. But a week, you can print that paper. We were in the first 3 days. You get it ready and go to press, and then you got about 3 days left there, or part of a week. Your help don't have much to do, but you can use that for job work. And that pays his wages, and you have money left. We were making money in the job work department doing lots of it. So I'd say if you have a weekly newspaper, you need both. And another thing, it's a community service. If you don't do that work, they got to go hunt up somewhere else and send it well somewhere, or old mail order and things of that kind, you know. We used to print thousands of canvas cards. I ordered 300,000 at one time down there from Long Island. But after we went out of business, they had to go to Kayser Blair, some agent here, and pay down a little bit of it, and the rest of it would come in COD, and it'd be 4 to 6 weeks getting their printing. Candace came in and told me about that. If there's some way we can get our printing done, I said, "No, I guess not." After they bought out, of course, Citizen Voice down here in 75, I guess. They didn't run bad, but I collapsed down there. They got a girl in here, didn't know how to run the paper. It wasn't very popular, and she didn't know how to handle the public, and irritated them and all that. And the Shelbyville firm got disgusted with it, and finally sold to the competitor, Citizen Board. They took the paper up there. It's printed right here on Main Street, Ravenna, now, you know. They retained my name, called it the Citizen Board's Times, and they dropped the Hurl name out of it. And it's a pretty good paper. It's 20 pages now, long that way and all like that. It's not a local paper too much. They don't have too much local news, and lots of people confront me with, when are you going to start another paper? We don't like the one we got, and they like them. But they have a pretty good front page, I think. But they don't have that local news. So you can leave, actually leave the first page, go all the way through the paper. It's ads and features like syndicated articles and things of that kind. And articles about the farmers and the county agents, all these and things like that in there. It's not that dealing with personal issues from day to day, personality about people, like I used to do it. Ms. Holdmail worked for me 6 years after I went down there. And she was on the desk all the time, calling people about news. Got any news this week? Anybody this and that and the other? We'd act, whenever we get a tip about a news item, I'd send her right out, or I'd send somebody out and get it, develop the story. We really had a good paper. Our circulation got up to 5,000. And, but I don't know what they're doing down there now. It's a big paper, it's all like that. I don't know whether they're keeping up the circulation or not. So I don't know if several people stopped taking it.
Did you use local correspondents at all?
Had them all through the county. And they still got about 5 or 6 of them. They retained them, every one of them. It's the ones that I had. They continued to write for them. I'm a Clanny, a Callahan from Wagersville, and this is Heisel from Locust Branch, and this is Mrs. So-and-so out here from Patsy. I see the same people that I had, they retained them there. But they didn't get any new ones. Didn't used to, and I keep on reaching out and getting new ones for every area. I tried to cover every area. But
did you try and edit what your local correspondents wrote, or?
Well, you'd have to. The language was bad. I'd have Miss Holdmail type them up. She, that's what she was there for. You had to. You poor language, and maybe something wasn't been more than that. No way. They'd say something about, might be a little libelous and things like that. But I'd have to read it and hand it over to her and call her attention to how it should be done. Yeah.
When did you stop getting the ready print?
Oh, that stopped when they suspended the paper up there, the Sun. 1950. Mm-hmm. Now, a fellow came, a guy named Guy Bell came in there and started that paper up again and called it the Times. 16 and 17, and we were having a big oil boom here then. He printed 4 pages. We'd set up, he had a couple of printers working there, and they'd set up enough to print 4 pages. You print 2 and then turn it over and print the other. And he had big promotion articles about oil wells out here. Now, fellas starting getting drilled, this and that and the other. And the fellas got a lease, going to do this and that and the other. He made a racket out of it. These fellas would come in here and buy up those leases, and guy would get my big write up, you know, and they'd give him a couple of $100. They'd take them papers up on the stock exchange in New York, and sell a partnership. In these leases, you know, and things of that kind. Oh, he'd decide what he'd do. And he'd get drunk all the time. Bell did. He didn't stay here but a year or two. And he'd get in jail down there all weekend. He's a big, impressive fellow. And we had a police judge, chief of police named Philpott. And my second cousin, Barker, was a police judge. And the city attorney was Hay. So every time he'd get in jail, he said, well, I had to pay Phil Haybar off so they could get some coffee. He ridiculed those fellas. They all got a sherry, of course, a fine, the city attorney and the chief of police and so on. Phil Haybar. Well, let's see, that's about all you want to know, don't you? I might tell you that I've got quite a Kiwanis record. I'm the only, we chartered the Kiwanis Club in 1922. I'm the only surviving member that year. The, Mr. Bing died here last January. It was the last one. The two of us were in there for years, 50 years, I remember. He died last. I left me as the only surviving member. I was president there in 1950, and I was lieutenant governor of the division then. That included Madison and six counties, including Fayette and so on. I supervised the clubs in that division in 51. And then I became treasurer of this club in 55 and kept it 23 years. And then after I had my stroke, I dropped out, but when I got to walking a little bit, scooping around, getting back in the club again, they run out of secretaries and they had to put me in charge as a secretary. I've had that 2 years now. I'm still that. I had a Red Cross record. I was chairman 2 years. We had some tornadoes here and I was able to get aid for rehabilitate the people and rebuild houses that were blown away and things of that kind. I was on the library committee out there several years. And I was a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee to the Kentucky Legislative Research Committee by appointment of Governor Nunn. And I've been appointed Kentucky Colonel twice. Bert Combs, Governor Combs appointed me, and Governor Nunn. But as I said a while ago, I had some nice Democratic friends. Mark Lyle was one of them, Leanne was acting the chair for the party, his party. Arthur Smith was the Democratic mayor. Ed Garnett was Democratic representative. I met all three of them down there one day. And I said, I'll talk to you fellas a little bit. We had an old sorry fellow out here who'd been appointed to conduct the Colonel twice. He chipped everybody, but he managed to get appointed by Hattie Chandler, Colonel, and some of them. And I understand. I said, I'm one of the leading citizens of this community. I've run a newspaper here so many years. I've been on the side of community development, member of the Baptist Church. And I said, I don't understand why it is a good citizen like me can't be appointed a Kentucky Colonel. They looked at each other, or they would look at Mark. So you get that done, Casey. He said, yeah. Following Wednesday, Mark Lyle walked in and said, here you are. I was pointing to Bert Cohen, just joking with him, you know. Of course, later on, that Republican Nunn got in. He wasn't pointing me in, he did. I got them both in there. I never have framed either one of them. I ain't got any place to put them. And good many years, they thought I was interested in history. I was on the Estill County Historical Society a long time with Hattie Johnson and others. She's dead now. I joined the Masonic Fraternity in 1933, and I held all the offices in that organization all through the years. I belonged to the women's organizations, to the White Shrine and the Eastern Star, which she belongs to, both of them, and so on. You about covered everything you want now.
Where is the Campbell Press now? The old press?
A woman interested in setting up a place where you, a museum of a thing with old machinery and things of that kind. Mrs. Meadows over here at Clay City, you may have heard of her. She's a great person to raise flyers and things of that kind. She's right. And she'd heard about that, and she came over here and wanted to know what I was going to do with that press. I said, I don't know. What do you want? You want it? I said, yeah. What do you think? Well, I said, nothing. Do you want it? I want to take it over there and set it up in my building there with the rest of my things I've been accumulating. Artifacts and all a whole lot of junk over there she's got, you know. So she sent a couple of mechanics over here and dismantled that press. See, I'd already sold out then, wasn't using for anything. I stayed up in this building up here 2-3 years before I actually moved out of the oven, see, because still had that stuff in there. And finally, after I got that thing dismantled and sold that money, I paid $4,200 for it, but I sold it. Mr. Matthews told me, said, whatever you get, sold the man less than $300. They dismantled that press and took it over to the city. This man came and took the line that I built. And so one by one, I kept taking things out till finally one day, the woman that owned the building told me, she said, Parker said, my father, before he died, told me that if I ever wanted to sell that building, that you got the first preference for it. I said, now, I believe I'm going to sell it. He said, I'm getting up in years. And I said, well, I tell you, Emily, I don't believe I'll buy it. I'm going to have to move out of here anyway, down to the other place. And, if you have a sale for it, you sell it. She sold it to the man next door, Tom Delano. And I then had to move. I got the man then to move the rest of the stuff down to the other place. Oh, well, those type cases went down there and that wooden type, all that stuff you'd need for a handset paper. And we didn't have a room for it. We just stacked up those type cases down there on the floor and took that stereotype machine down there. They had one, but that made two, and put one of them in the back. Finally got everything out of there, and then I went down there and set myself up an office. The lattice work that I had up here, took it down there, and it worked out fine. I just built myself a nice little cubby hole down there, and I was up here about 3 years, and the other 3 years down there before we did. So it's a shame all that type had to die. That I had type there, and it wouldn't throw away that I'd used and setting up here in the old sun in 1913. Case it down over there, of course, some of it had dust in it. But she set everything by hand back then. You mm-hmm. see that done? A stick, 13 inches about that wide. You set that in there, put a lid on the side of it, and until you feel it, got the stick pulled, you take it out, put it on a gather then. And
how long did it take you to set a page by hand?
You mean handset?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it would might be 3 hours or so before you get that thing. Depending on how fast you get it. Of course, you get pretty fast. After you get your line back through, I used to set a column line back in about 3/4 of an hour. They do that. That was a great invention in 1888, and it was used extensively until this offset business started coming around. They're out of date now, though. Some Java shops have to use them yet. We kept that going down there while we set the classified ads on. And you take a proof, of course, and then paste that on your makeup. Just take a proof of it. Because they'd come in, just keep coming in, little classifieds and things of that kind. And, but we were being printed over at Cynthia Anna. That big plane over there then. That company owned all these papers then, 15 and 16 of them. They had a big cash press over there. We'd make up down there our pages and paste them up and take them over there and type on the paper and bring them back because we had the mailing here.
When did you leave, officially retire from the newspaper business? When the Times Herald, right?
April 13th, 74, and I had my stroke.
74.
I was hospitalized some quite a few weeks, and they didn't think I'd live a while. I couldn't speak, you know. But I went out here at this hospital for several weeks. Finally, one night, nurses were watching me, and I got to sweating. They changed my clothes 4 or 5 times in the night. A fever or something broke, and next morning the nurse came in there and talked to me, and I said something to her. Helen come every morning. She walked in there and says, he spoke. She said, he did? No, he didn't. Yes, he did. She came in there, and I was able to say a few words, and they took good care of me out there. A little later on, they said, you do that kind of therapy before you get his legs to work. His leg down there, it just paralyzed it. about the knee down is what it was. Of course, I've been immobilized and couldn't walk. I just laid inside my back here after they brought me home. And then they said, well, maybe you had therapy. They took me over to Kenwood Prison. And they got me over there. And of course, that hand wasn't in use. That's just not there then. And they wouldn't feed me. They didn't treat me right there. I stayed about 3-4 weeks, I guess it was. And Dr. Clark was my doctor. You know him over there, Dr. Clark?
Mm-hmm.
His office out there, the medical doctor. An old friend of mine. He's the son of a cashier at the bank here. And he was raised in there. And told me, he says, he turned out to be a friend of mine. He said, you ain't doing no good here. Can't eat, they won't feed you. See, I couldn't cook meat. Maybe I'd pick up something, drink a little something. No food wasn't any good anyway. That's a sorry place. And he said, I'm going to send you over to Patty Clay where you get better treatment. Maybe you can eat something over there. So on. He told my wife up. He said, I'm going to send him to the hospital unless you want to take him home or bring him back over there. She said, put him in that hospital and you look after him. She came on over that night. I stayed there 2-3 weeks. And that therapist came in there, and I wasn't ready for a therapist thing. She took me down there in the room and tried to have me walk. I couldn't walk and got a little stomach turn. And I could take me back to bed. And then they set me up in a chair there and tie me up, you know, but that wasn't any good. Finally, Dr. Clark says, I tell you, they've got a service now, an in-home service, a therapist, and they can do lots for you. They put me in touch with that service, and Miss Mary Davis came over here, started coming, and brother, she was good, and she's still doing that in this community, incidentally. Everybody found out that she did so much for me, everybody gets paralyzed now or something, called Barker's out there, found out who that was he had. This prominent woman on Main Street, Carrie Mitchell. She got touch with us, and former county attorney Lord Stevens' wife had a hip broke. They called here, and we put her home for that. Lucy Scott down here, her mother, she came and waited on her. And, well, she twisted my ankles around down there, you know, come back up this way to me, and she get a hold of this arm and pulled me way back. She developed those muscles, see? And I hollered and I'd squeak. I said, well, you're hurting me. I said, I know, but I got to do this. She was good. The first thing you know, I was sitting on the side of the bed. And then we got a wheelchair. She put me up in a wheelchair, and I drove myself around here. And went in here, watched TV about 30 minutes, and I'd have to go back to bed. And then finally this Mark Lyle I told you about, he's dead now, he wasn't there. He had a walker. He loaned it to me. And I finally got to where I could walk through the house here, see? And that developed that hand, I got back that hand, I'm running just as good as ever. And I run my typewriter and things of that kind. my machine was getting antiquated, and I had a man run my line at that. He'd had a few heart attacks. I had a mute that was set in type for me. I mean, job work and run them off down there. He was getting old, and I said, well, the machine is wearing out, my men are wearing out, and I'm 67, and I better sell. And that's what prompted me to sell. Mm-hmm. And see, I'd been going to Georgetown for 18 months, taking my paper over, and they would bring it anyway. It was still profitable. I'd pay them, of course. They'd give me a monthly statement. But I could print more pages that way. I'd get enough 15, 16 pages and things of that kind of paper. But I could see that how much longer was I going to live, and what was going to terminate there. And it was a smart move on my part, because that operator I had, he died about a year after that, and the mute, well, he stayed and worked with his son down there, but he had a heart attack and died. And you couldn't get a printer then to come in and run a line of type and work, you know, less than $400-$500 a month. And they weren't charging me that much. This old man sitting in the line of type, he worked 3 days a week. So he come in and do that part-time, and of course the mute didn't charge too much. He wasn't breaking me up. The wages, I could see that it was going to be an impossible situation, and I decided to sell, and I knew that this firm down there was well, they were well equipped, they had quite a plan. And I didn't know just how to terminate. He said, I had to work on, I ain't got nobody else. Worked 3-4 years for me anyway, if I get somebody. Well, I stayed in six, and that's what prompted me to make the change, mm-hmm. go down there. I could see this offset coming, and it's changing now, it's so fast. Just they're getting so now they just take a vision or something other, and it's ready for print. That's equipment and all. I don't know. It's just technologies are advancing so fast in the printing business. Mm-hmm. You can't hardly keep up with it. Yours is journalism, isn't it? Mm-hmm. How? Where you been studying? Well, I got along splendidly with him. He left me to make decisions. Anything I decided up here, he'd stick by me on. Sometimes we'd get into a little controversy with somebody, and they'd try to override me, write him a letter. And one fellow owed him down there. He tried to beat us out of the printing bill. I can't. He sneaked in there and got it away from Denny when I wasn't in there. I wrote him a pretty strong letter about it. Get that, you order paid when you got your stuff and so on. He took that up with Matthew, and Matthews called me up and said, you got a little stout with him, didn't you? I said, yeah, but I represent you like I would myself. He's a damn crook, and I wasn't going to let him beat you out of the money. He said, well, that's all right. He wrote me this letter here about you and sent me a copy of your letter. I said, yeah, that's all right. I don't deny it a bit. I'm trying to represent you just like I would myself. Ain't nobody going to beat me out of anything here. And yeah, he was pretty nice to me. But that was Newspapers Incorporated then. Then they sold out to Landmark. That's a firm based in Norfolk, Virginia, I think. And he continued then as manager of their firm, headquarters there, Shelbyville. When did you work for him before that?
Right when he started, Shelbyville. 68, 69, 70.
Well, a bunch of them folks got together, see, then, went up that plant out there. It's out there close to, just beyond Shelbyville, huh? You know where it is. Did you work there? That work mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would it be, could another newspaper make it in Irvin today?
Well, I tell you, I believe you could.
What would you have to do?
This competition wouldn't be too bad. They don't like Hatfield. And this town is getting to be a good advertising town now. You see, when we were running the paper back in the old days, you'd get a little old ad about a restaurant or a little something or other. You didn't have any big department houses and thing. But look what he's got now. He's got Kroger with Pages every week, A&P, Begley, Maloney, $7. And there's another store coming in down here that'll be convenient. And Farm and Home, they're good advertisers down here. And Esther Farm, they're good advertisers. And it's just a good advertising. Now, have you seen one of the papers lately?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've seen them. But it's just, of course, with one paper in town, you become what's known as the official paper. That used to be important to me as a little weekly newspaper. The foreclosures, commission sales, we call them. You'd give $1 an inch, you know. No, 50 cents an inch then. A day, a week is in dollars a day. But we were just getting about 20 cents for display ad. And that 50 cents was a pretty good bonus, you know. You get a commission sale out of a certain court and run it three times, and you get $16, $17 out of a sale, don't you see? One year I had $990 worth of commission sale. That's in the Depression years when they were foreclosing. The banks and savings and loan associations, one thing or another, were having to foreclose on people, and those things had to be run in the paper. And I lived on that one season here, just practicing during the Depression years when you didn't have any other ads at all. I lived through those 30 years right there, and I had that printing office right across the street from City Hall. And there were 3-4 weeks there one time that I got dust on my jaw press, didn't have anything to do. And of course I was doing a lot of my own work. I could run my line at that. Nobody could put me in a hole. I'd work nights, way up daylight, necessary, setting up to run the paper. And so I was always able to cope with it, but you didn't, it's just tight. Money was cheap then. A dollar would buy a lot at the grocery store then. All like that, and the subscription price was just $1 a year, and I got linked up with the Pathfinder in Washington, and I got to run an ad both for the price of $1, and I'd send them 20 cents for there, and I have 80 cents left. But during the middle of the Depression, though, on about 33 or 34, they had to set up a WPA office right across the street in front of me over there. They were, everybody were out of work, and they had WPA workers here building roads and hacking out. And they'd go over and sign up, people would, and they were getting $1.60 a day for 3 days a week. They wouldn't let you work over 3 days. They wanted to splice the work and let others have a whack at it too, don't you see? And one day, Miss Lewis Snowden, she was secretary over there, she came over. She said, "Bob, we gotta have some payroll sheets here printed." And she said, "Now they don't pay in cash." She said, "Could I give you an order for groceries?" I said, "Bring it over here, damn it, I gotta eat too." And I printed that big thing up there, set up on my hat and under some payroll sheets. And she gave me an order for $9. We went down the store and just loaded up with canned goods and coffee and sugar and things. Decide what you can buy then for $9. And that's, I'm just telling you about the hard times I've had back in those days.
Did you get the public notices and commissioner sales because you were the only newspaper then?
No, I got it because the circuit judge was a Republican. You know, I got them all the time. Well, because Old Mail was supposed to be a Democrat, and Benson was too. The commission would bring all of them to me. And the sheriff said it too, he was Republican. And the county clerk, I got printing ballots too, he was Republican. And Old Mayor was a very competitive now, he was tough. Al isn't, he still is, but his brother was, he was mean. And well, they noticed that one day the 50th court decided they wanted to get a bid on the ballots, and they had a Democrat clerk that time, that's Mr. Park, and what the court said, "You want to get that done where you get it cheapest, thing. Why don't you get a bid on that?" Well, Mr. Lyle, then, he called me in, he, Democrat, and said, we're going to bid on these ballots. I said, well, the Herald's going to get it. I know, but they want to bid. I said, well, you don't have to go to bed. Under the law, the clerk has the absolute prerogative to have the ballots printed, and you can't question his authority to do that, except it's excessive. The 50 court can say it's too high, and they have to pay the bill that is within reason. That still is. An administrative officer, you can't hamper him in the handling of his duties. You understand that? And I said, you don't have to. I know, but we're going to do that. I said, well, if you're going to do that, how are you going to do it? The sealed bid, said, yeah. I said, well, I'll give you a bid, but I said, when do you want to open it in? Well, if you can get it in here, we'll open up at 10 o'clock tomorrow. I said, well, I'll be here at 10 o'clock and you can open the bid. And I went over at 10 o'clock. He said, well, we got to open the bids and the whole man got it. I said, you're going to wait like on to do that. And he said, I know, but let me see that bid. And I got it. Here's what it said. I hereby agree to print the ballots for Estill County 25 cents cheaper than any other bid submitted. I said, Mr. Lyle, that ain't no bid. I didn't expect you to be honest with me in the first place. You're a Democrat, I'm a Republican. I didn't want to mess with it anyway. I just thought, if you want to do it fair, though, I'd bid on it. And I said, you just go to hell for what I'm concerned. Now, you won't be clerk here next term. I'll see you're beat. And I did. I got very busy in 41 and got Maggie Wolfenberger along to the office. And she beat him 400 votes and got him out of there. And I took a personal hand in that election. I knew politics in this county. And back in those days, half the election officers had to be Republican, half of them had to be Democrats. They would alternate. The sheriff would be a Democrat in one precinct, and the clerk would be a Republican, and vice versa. Next, take them. Usually the commissioner would say, give me the odd numbers, and I'll take the even numbers. There wasn't too much friction about that. But the sheriff had the deciding vote. If a vote was challenged, the judges couldn't agree, the sheriff was untied. Well, that election came on, and I went down there. I'd been sitting hell enough for to check votes, and they'd been buying votes and looking through the knotholes and everything else in the schoolhouse precinct and all. I went down to the sheriff and told him, I said, I want to be appointed sheriff of the election in the schoolhouse precinct. And he said, he named me. And I said, I want Lord Stevens to be the Republican judge. He said, all right. And they named Clark White as a Democrat judge. He moved to Franklin. And I was going to challenge his vote anyway. I went up there to challenge those votes and get the illegal votes out of there. I knew what the law was, and I was determined to do it. I had the guts and the courage to do it. So Mr. John Lyle lived next door. He was a Democratic commissioner, a friend of mine. I went over and told him, I said, Mr. Lyle, don't know fiction about the election. I said, you got Clark White named there for that judge election up there. I said, he's moved to Franklin, I'm going to challenge the vote. I said, don't want any interruption in the voting up there. Why don't you go and change your order over there and appoint somebody else there? Well, he said, all right, I'll do that. I go on in trouble. I said, well, he's in Franklin, and he can't come up here and be election officer to vote. So he did. He put in Mr. Kraut. And I went up there that day. I had a list of these illegal voters, 22 of them. Some of them been convicted of stealing coal and hadn't been pardoned, things of that kind. I had a whole list of them. Of course, I had a deciding vote. And whenever one come in, I said, you can't vote, I have to challenge your vote. Well, I've been moving there all the time. I had my chewing gum over there today. And, Mrs. Dozier would speak up the Democrat woman, and she'd say, well, we'll have to take a vote on that, don't we? I said, yeah, you can do that if you want to. So she'd vote, let him vote, and Mr. Stevens said, I told Lawrence, I said, now listen, I ain't going no spineless. If you can't have the courage to stick to me up there, don't you go up there. I'll get somebody else. No, he said, I'll stick with you. I'm not going to challenge anybody except Rosie legally. But I said, don't go hum and hawing around about it. Somebody say, oh, I've been here all my life, I've got to ride the road and all. I said, if they're not going to vote, if they're not entitled to vote, hear what you say. Well, sure enough, everyone I'd challenge, well, it'd be a tie vote. Of course, if one man, she'd go tell me. I said, well, I haven't decided to vote. I declared it illegal. Don't give him a ballot for it. And I run off 19 like that, and about half a day, the county attorney came up there. He's raising Cain about it. He was a Democrat county attorney then. And I challenged Clark's mother, and Clark himself, and his sister. They all lived in Frankfort. He said, what are you trying to do? I'm appointed my duty, I said, as sheriff's election man. What's your instinct? Why, he said, you'll get arrested doing that. I know I won't. I said, if you try to arrest me, I said, there'll be somebody else in here. You can interrupt the voting here. This will be a Democrat precinct. I said, you won't win by that. I said, now you're not entitled to be in here anymore than I am. You're supposed to stay 50 feet away from here. You get on back away from here. Leave me alone. I said, well, I'll get a warrant after you for interfering with election. So he left. Well, Clark, of course, is we've been personal friends, played a lot of bridge and drank around together and all like that. And he said, oh, let me vote. Let my mother vote. I said, no, Clark, I ain't going to do it. And he said, well, I just want to vote so bad. I said, I know you do. He said, what are you trying to do? I said, I'm trying to beat George Lyle. Damned old crook cheated me, and I'm going to get enough votes in this county this time to elect Maggie Wolfenbarger. And I'm going to do it legally. Well, all right, so he went away. After that, he was all right. We played some more bridge. He said, well, that was a tough election, but he said, I don't blame you. You stood your ground. I wasn't going to be budged. And I had the same thing happen there with number one bridge there. Another two coming up here, voting every election from down to Frankfort and having a big down and getting 3 days off and then go back and this and that and another. And I had another election officer down there, and I coached him just like I did myself. I had him appointed as a sheriff. I said, now, Claude, don't challenge anybody at all unless you're going to stop them. Just don't give them a ballot. He stood his ground, run some off there, and I had him going up here and bent the same way. I had him picked all over the county. She won about 241 votes then. And after that, she never did lose an election. She elected five times after that. She was so popular. She's a right fine woman. She lived down here with Whit now on Main Street there. And her daughter, of course, was clerk after that, Mildred Cobb. She's the minister out here at this nursing health thing now. And but she was always grateful to me for that, and I got the ballots that went from that on while she was in there. But oh wow, I got mad when he pulled that trick on me there. I've always been standing for my convictions and a fighter. Had the courage of my convictions, and I ain't sorry of it at all. See, back in those days, you take the ballots to the courthouse, and Ben Scott came up there. He's still living out there now. I'd been having to count the votes there in the central office. He came up there and said, you went up there and come downtown there. I said, Clark Potts down there raising Cain is going to have trouble. I said, well, I've been counting votes all the time and I'm going to count tonight. You know what he does, he ain't nothing to him. I went on up there and counted. There wasn't no trouble at all. It wasn't nothing to go in the election about in the paper at all. Mm-hmm. It's just that he came and tried to interfere up there about that.
Is there anything you'd like to add
to this tape recording, memories of Irvin working here in the newspaper business.
Do I have anything to add?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, there's so much of it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
See, I ran with the times in my tenure down there, was 52 years. There's so much of it I couldn't relate, I guess. I just picked out a few of these other incidents I told you about a while ago. But I'm happy about it. You know, when you're young and you don't know what your career is going to be, we don't ever get to do what we want to do. You have to do what your opportunities are. Now, my opportunities are to learn to be a printer just by accident. That kind of molded my life to a certain extent. And now I've always had a high regard for history and geography and newspaper fraternity and all. And I take a lot of magazines and newspapers here and read all the time. And of course, sometimes I get a little nostalgic about the thing. I was able to be doing something like that now, but I had to just resign myself to being retired. And we're living happily here now. My wife's nice to me, and my health is fair.
Mm-hmm.
We don't worry about anything financially. I didn't get my Social Security as long as I was working. I was getting a salary on there. I didn't apply for Social Security until I was 72. I paid in the limit, frankly. And when I did get it, I was able to get it, and she became 65 that same year. And we're both on it now. It's very substantial, and increases 6% every July 1st. So we're not worried about anything. We can do anything we want to do, of course. At my age, I can't get out and go many places. I'd like to travel. I love that. I used to fly around a lot over the country. I used to play the races a lot at Churchill Downs and Miami and around. I'd fly to those places, Chicago and Detroit and things like that. And I had to put a useful life and got no regrets about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some things I've done I wish I could take back, but I'm reconciled to that. You can't change what's happened.
I have one other question I meant to ask everybody in Estill County. Why has Irvin and Ravenna grown up as two different communities when they're so close to each other?
That occurred back in 1912 when the railroad wanted to come in here. Of course, they wanted to go up to the eastern Kentucky mountains to get the coal out. We were having a railroad, just a little one, L&A, coming out of Frankfort through Richmond, Marbley, and they came and crossing down here, the turnstile right here in Irvin. That's as far as it went for a while. A little later on, it got as far as Babel. Now, that's all the train service you had in there then. But then this L&M wanted to get their lines through to Hazard and all up in there. And they came from Winchester through here. Debbie and I is what they called that one. Well, I wanted a place here to put up the shops. And they tried to get a place down here at the end of Main Street, and they wouldn't sell them the lots and one thing or another. They went arguing around. And the little town of Irvin itself wasn't too friendly toward them coming in. So, some people up here lived on this end of town, who J.F. West lived up here in East Irvin. He owned some land over in there and some other people, and they said, well, you can have that land over there. If you want to bring the shops in here and give employment to people and run your railroad in here, you're welcome to it. And because of the animosity engendered by Irvin not being so friendly, the L&N practically promoted the town of Ravenna. They had the Sawyer Realty Company come in here, and they began laying off lots. This was a pasture here with old-fashioned fences going around up there going up Calgary. The road come out through here.
On 6th Street and Elm Street?
Well, it came right down here about Chandler Branch where you first hit there and crisscrossed right through here, passed by this Christian church, went out along through here and I went around up that way. Nothing here but cowbells. You could hear and see cows out here browsing around. It's all farmland. And but they inspired, that's the word, that this town incorporated. Sawyers started building houses, and other contractors were busy here, and they began putting up houses all over town here, and the move started then to incorporate. And I think it was, the old name would have been down on the other end of town someplace if they'd been encouraged, but these people up here invited them in more, and to this day, that friction still exists. Ravenna, there's been some moves made to consolidate with Urban, but these Ravenna people simply do not want it. And they try to say pull them both together and be the cheaper one, fire department, one, be all that stuff, you know. Well, we moved here in 1945. I bought this little house then and moved in here since that time. And there's still no cinema in Ravenna for hooking up with Urban. And I don't think Urban's want to do it. They said, well, we don't have no problem. People that don't want it, don't want to be in with us, we don't. So it's never been pushed. And then there's another thing they used to talk about. They wanted their own postmaster down here, post office, and name, keep the name of the town they were proud of and so on. And there's been quite a little meetings were had or moves made to consolidate, always fell through because there wasn't a cinema for it.